Good evening and welcome to the first Quids In podcast of 2016. We've got a very lovely new bunch of analysts here with Quids In, so we're very excited to have you all. And it's also the first year for Quids In that we're having a national investment league. So this is the Nottingham Fund's first radio show. Also on Quids In, we have Oxford, UCL and Exeter all competing to become the best performing fund, the best radio show, university with the best research. And so the Nottingham team here, I think we've got a good chance of being the best, but we're just going to do a bit of an introduction. So my name is George, I'm the co-founder.
My name's Lawrence, I'm the other co-founder.
Hello, my name's Trishul. I'm the Division Manager for Energies and Industrials.
Hello, my name's Glenn and I am in the Energy and Industrials area.
Hi there, I'm Michael. I'm the Division Manager for the Financials.
Hello, I'm Naman. I'm an analyst in the financial sector.
Hi, I'm Max and I'm also part of the financial sector.
So we're going to start with a macro roundup, which I think Trishul's produced, and we're going to start looking at the UK economy at the current stage.
Yeah, so some of the key things which have happened in the UK economy as of recently is obviously the Autumn Statement. And so in brief summary, some of the key points from the Autumn Statement is that Chancellor Hammond has announced that he wants to invest $2.3 billion in housing infrastructure to fund over 100,000 new homes in high demand areas, and he wants to make sure $1.4 billion is made available to deliver 40,000 additional affordable homes. Another key point from the Autumn Statement was that Hammond wants to ban letting agencies as soon as possible, and this has been one of the major key talking points in the UK as of right now. And moving on over to the US, one of the key highlights in the US right now is obviously the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, known as TTP, which has made headlines this week as President-elect Donald Trump has pledged on Monday to withdraw the United States from the deal within the first 100 days of his presidency. So moving on to Eurozone, one of the key topics in Eurozone right now is actually the European Parliament, who actually voted a majority to ask the European governments to suspend talks with Turkey regarding their EU membership. And this has obviously increased tensions between EU members around the world, and especially between the EU and the president of Turkey. Another key thing in the Eurozone right now is Angela Merkel has announced that she will be running again to remain as the German Chancellor, and this will be interesting to see how this plays out, especially with the world changing so drastically with obviously President-elect Donald Trump and Brexit. And finally, moving over to India, one of the key talking points over here is how India is actually struggling right now to deal with the grappling effects of withdrawing 86% of its cash from circulation, a chronic shortage of banknotes in the cash-dominated economy has left most trades depressed. And a quick fact over here, 7 out of 10 family-owned grocers have suffered a decline in business, according to a survey by a consultancy firm. However, India's Prime Minister Modi has said that this will be a temporary pain, and at the end of it will all be worth it, and his goal from this is to flush out black money.
Thank you for the quick roundup there, Trisha. I think what we're going to do there is open the floor up to a few questions, if that's okay with you, and sort of discussion and debate over some of the points raised there. Key on that is the sort of new UK budget and the sort of eradication of this budget surplus target by 2019. Do you think that will the sort of increase in infrastructure spending will help offset the impacts of Brexit, or do you think that we'll still see some recession and some sort of negative effects post-Brexit?
I think definitely there'll still be some deep consequences post-Brexit. There was actually some interesting facts regarding which came out as soon as this Autumn Statement got released, which was the fact that the UK would actually need an additional $60 billion in borrowing from the UK government. So despite these massive, you know, claims of $2.3 billion in infrastructure, I still do think there was going to be some negative effects of the Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, we all know that investment is one of the main parts that drives economic growth. However, there has already been major capital flight outside the UK, and we expect that there's going to be a lot more in the following years, especially when the Brexit does start to, you know, actually happen. So I think even though there has been a few talks that investment will increase, I think the overall effect is still going to be kind of negative.
I think it'd be interesting to consider the increase in fiscal stimulus in the UK with this comparison sort of Trump's fiscal stimulus, as you mentioned, in the US there, Trisha, as well. I think although we're very different sort of junctures there, it'd be quite interesting to see should increase in infrastructure or increase in fiscal stimulus actually be proven to sort of help the economy grow rather than this sort of open and expansionary monetary policy we've got currently?
Yeah, I think just touching up on that, I think worldwide we've seen this common phenomena amongst many central banks across the world that maybe monetary policy is its effects is starting to fade away, and I think many central bankers are now and governments are now starting to really realize that maybe it's time to reintroduce fiscal policy. And we've seen the Bank of Japan recently introduce a major fiscal stimulus package, and we also saw Canada's Prime Minister also suggest ideas of him wanting to implement fiscal packages as well. So I think that's quite a common theme across the world right now.
I would agree, definitely, from my work over the summer as well, that sort of the consensus that a lot of research is looking towards and sort of moving away from this monetary policy and just sort of easy money, which really isn't getting us anywhere.
That's interesting stuff. And also one note I'd add is the fact that a lot of this change in fiscal policy and the sort of expansion in spending is coming from traditionally conservative parties. It's interesting how it actually is now sort of that populist anti-globalization movement that's now infiltrating into these conservative parties. So on that theme, moving to the US, which is the second theme that Trisha brought to you, talking about TPP, which is the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Deal, and also TTIP, which is the European and American Free Trade Deal. They're both having some troubled times. Looks very likely that the US is not going to be ratifying either of these. So my question to the panel is, do you think this is the end for free trade pacts? Do you think that we're going to see a continued decline in free trade, or do you think this is just a temporary blip?
Okay, I'd say right now this is a temporary blip. I definitely think this is one of the more radical kind of policies that Trump wanted to implement. Whether it actually goes through, we'll see through Congress and the Senate. But I think trade is the way to go forward. And I think whilst many people and there's a lot of economists that say protectionism is probably the way to go right now to really fuel the economy, I do think following Brexit as well that we'll be trying to sign agreements with countries such as Australia, India and China. So I don't think it's the end of free trade agreements and of that sort. And I'm sure the same will be for US, who will try to form agreements with other countries.
I would also counter that, although you may say it'd be a temporary blip, I think if you look at the sort of upcoming elections and referendums in sort of, you know, France and the Netherlands and Denmark, I think we could potentially see more of a breakup of globalisation, so this anti-globalisation move, which, you know, really maybe isn't such a temporary blip and is more of the consensus moving forward. So the final part you mentioned there on India, has anyone got any comments to add on that part?
I think it's quite an interesting topic right now. So actually I'm actually writing about this in one of my modules, monetary economics, and the question I've been talking about in this actual module is, what are the limits of negative interest rates and beyond which they cannot go? And one of the key theories that many economists have suggested in trying to eliminate the lower bound, or the zero lower bound, as many of you may know, is actually switching to an economy which is 100% digital and actually abolishing physical cash. And it's interesting to see how India are actually dealing with this. They're obviously trying to move to a digital economy. We've seen Sweden adopt this type of economy as well. So it's very interesting to see how there's contrast and effects. We see India, who are right now struggling, and obviously it's only been a few days since they've actually implemented this policy, but it's a very drastic kind of effect which they're seeing compared to Sweden, who actually are doing quite well with the new digital economy right now.
Yeah, I think part of the difficulty with India was that a lot of the industries sort of are very black market or sort of, you know, off the records, and that are really cash driven, which was kind of one of the biggest issues with the Indian policy there. So moving on, we're really going to look at sort of the company angles, the industry specific angles now, starting with Michael in the financial sector.
Yeah, so thanks, Lawrence. As you mentioned, we're going to be covering the financial sector of different regions. I'll be starting off with the EU. Now, as you guys probably anticipate, there's not much news in the past months coming from the EU. Most of it is coming from the US, which Max will be covering later. However, in the past week, we have had some action, which has been affected mostly by Italy's referendum on Sunday, which referendum comes and poses another threat on the sustainability of the and durability of the European Union. Now, if the In the case that the no vote does dominate the referendum, the Italian Prime Minister has claimed that he will step down from his position, so we should expect after in the following week great uncertainty in the Italian and also in European markets, as well possibly some capital flight towards other safer markets. The ECB, however, did come out today with an announcement claiming that they are willing to temporarily step up purchases of Italian government bonds if needed through their monthly bond buying program in an attempt to kind of calm the markets and soothe the markets. But it did partially affect the news. However, we will continue to look at Italy with caution while making our investment decisions. The Italian economy was also affected in this week by troubles from one of its biggest banks, which is also the oldest bank in the world. Now, I'm going to try and say this right. It's called Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena. Now, it was during the summer, it was revealed that the bank failed several stress tests, and the bank also has $30 billion worth of bad loans in its current balance sheet, which represent a value of 20% of loans of the entire Italy. Now, many investors are afraid that we are moving towards kind of a banking crisis in Italy, which will if it actually occurs, will definitely contribute towards a larger crisis in the Eurozone, which while we're making our investment investment decisions, we are going to be looking at. And finally, moving towards future stock prospects, the Bank of Cyprus, which is currently listed only in Cyprus and Greece, is looking to list in the London Stock Exchange and expand in the UK. Now, under John Hourican, who is a senior executive at RBS, the Bank of Cyprus has undergone radical restructuring and has repaid all but $800 million of its $11.4 billion liquidity assistance, emergency liquidity assistance. So definitely a healthy the financial aspects of the bank is definitely improving, and it reported $120 million of pre-tax profits in the first 9 months of 2016. It also increased customers by 10%. So it's definitely an interesting choice we might be looking towards when making the our choice on the investment portfolio.
It's very interesting. There's definitely points to consider about the Italian banking sector. There's these non-performing loans, they're called. I think they have no actual chance of being paid off. So they're just toxic debt that will never actually recoup its value. So definitely areas to avoid, and any sort of potential linked financial stocks to that also to avoid as well. Definitely. I think, Max, you're now going to cover the US sector and the US financial sector and sort of Trump's impact on financial stocks there as well.
Yeah. So since Donald Trump's election on the 8th of November, the financial sector's really been booming. The value of US banks has inflated by $300 billion, which is the most ever for this group. And they've been outperforming the S&P 500 index by 13.6% and trading at 1.3 times their book value and a multiple which is 60% above the five-year average. This is largely because of Trump's rather sketchy economic policy that he's laid out, which centres around reducing tax rates, rolling back regulation, and increasing infrastructure and public spending. With regard to regulation, he's looking to lift the legislation that Obama put in place in 2010, which put a lot of restraint on banks' more risky lending strategies, which are obviously more profitable for these banks. Essentially, he's going to attempt to employ a Federal Reserve Vice Chairman of Supervision, which is responsible for employing the legislation that was put in place to control the banks. In terms of repealing the measures that were put in place, while he may attempt to do it, Congress is probably still going to be quite sceptical, as they were put in place to prevent another crisis such as 2008 reoccurring. But even if he's unsuccessful at this, the Federal Reserve Vice Chairman of Supervision measures simply not enforce the measures as strongly as under Obama. With regard to fixing infrastructure and public spending, this could see a welcome boost for the banking sector, with increases in GDP could lead to jobs and inflation. With higher inflation, the Federal Reserve, which is making an announcement next month where it's expected to hike interest rates, could further pop up interest rates, which would help to help bank margins, which have been put under pressure from consistently low interest rates over the past few years.
I think it's interesting the point you mentioned on the Volcker and the Dodd-Frank Act there, and how Trump may repeal those. Yeah. I think it's very interesting that he's saying he'll do these and, you know, allow the banks to sort of prop trade again and make their own investment decisions, and the traders to actually, you know, use the bank's money or use clients' money to actually trade. What it really, I think, stands out from that is even if they do go through, they're binding across Europe, they're binding across the UK, in the majority of other markets apart from Asia. So all banks that trade within those markets wouldn't really be able to sort of, you know, exploit that across the globe. Naaman, I think you're going to conclude for us.
So I'm just going to talk about the financial news in UK and a merger that's going to occur. So retail banks seem to be underperforming in the UK. Banks based in Britain may start to relocate activities to other European countries like Dublin, France and Paris about 18 months before a British departure from the European Union, if a hard Brexit looks likely, Bank of England Governor Mark Carney said on Tuesday. Moreover, some large banks which use London to run the EU operations have said they could start moving staff as early as 2017 if there is no clarity on whether Britain will have a single market access. In other news, Clydesdale and Yorkshire Bank boss David Duffy is to take on the Williams & Glyne business being sold by Royal Bank of Scotland, said the Daily Telegraph. A number of analysts have questioned the decision to make an offer for the 314-strong branch network, saying it is overambitious as it would effectively double the size of the bank. Duffy added his management team had run many banks many times the size of this bank and engaged in acquisitions, disposals and restructurings of significant scale in the past. He also seemed to suggest the group is only engaged in talks because it is confident it can pull off the financing and regulatory approvals, said the Financial Times. In conclusion, while the CEO seems to be optimistic about the merger, the analysts have their own concerns. That's it.
Very interesting. As the financials team, quickly sum up, well, in 20 seconds, how likely do you think the move will be for banks out and jobs from the city to other jurisdictions such as Dublin or Paris or Frankfurt?
I think, right after the decision of Brexit, it was kind of a definite decision that after Brexit, major, like the City of London will no longer exist and major investment banks are going to be moving outside the UK. But I think now that the first actual numbers are in and banks have had the opportunity to actually realise what the Brexit is on their business and on their financial numbers, I think there's slightly of a smaller chance that it will actually occur.
Yeah, I think it's a waiting game still. Article 50 still hasn't been invoked, and it depends really on how hard Brexit is hit as to how it does affect the City of London.
Okay, thank you, the Financial Division. They're really interesting stuff. So we're going to move on to the Energy Division now, and we're just going to start with a few macro issues on the theme of Trump that I imagine will come up many, many times in the coming weeks because he's so controversial and we imagine there would be quite a lot of change under his presidency. So we'll start off with the effect on renewables. So Trump, during his campaign, called global warming a hoax, promised to quit the Paris Climate Agreement and has generally had a very negative approach to renewables. But at the same time, there's also quite a lot of positive messages from the renewable community saying, actually, well, the fundamentals are there now that solar is at parity with many fossil fuels, and just because Trump's the president, it's not going to stop us. So what's your opinion on the Trump presidency and its effect on the renewables industry?
I think definitely it will. We saw after the day of the election when Trump was announced that he was the winner, there was a massive negative effect on share prices of renewables, and they did take a massive hit, right? And I think However, as you mentioned, right, so although the fundamentals are there for renewable energy, and I think that will be the case, so I think renewables will be fine in the long run. We've seen that obviously with technology advancing so much, there is a general shift towards renewable energy and electrical rather than moving away from fossil fuels. So while in the short term they have taken a hit, I think in the long run they'll be able to survive this new policies of Trump, where he says he wants to scrap all of these regulations and stuff like that.
I would tend to agree. However, I would also like to point out that renewables as a whole do not have the capabilities to stimulate the economy on a global scale, purely because if you look at the figures, they purely don't produce enough energy for us to be able to cope with that, and we're always going to need a different area to produce our energy, such as whether it be nuclear or currently fossil fuels, as we can see.
Interesting stuff. And what do you think the role of China is? Because the Chinese government, they've got massive pollution in their cities. The population is very worried about global warming. Do you think that this is going to give an advantage to the solar manufacturers from China over America?
I think definitely. I think there was always a case with Chinese solar panels being relatively cheaper than the ones manufactured in the US or even here. So I think that coupled with this will definitely give them a major advantage. And I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing, you know, a massive boom in the Chinese solar panel industry.
Staying in the US, Glenn, so what's your opinion on the sort of developments in the shale gas industry?
Well, obviously, natural gas industry in the US is a huge sector that's growing all the time, really. But with current warmer than average weather and forecast of this weather to turn slightly cooler over time, we have seen the natural gas industry and the prices of the gas reach a 3-week high on Tuesday. And this has meant that, obviously, people are demanding gas purely to heat their homes because they are ready for this change in the weather. The US as a whole is actually a net exporter of natural gas, obviously with the development of fracking and such the technologies on the eastern coast. And this means that, as I said, it's a net exporter and it's reshaping the global energy business. However, with this blast of cold weather, this could also mean that heating demands are going to rise, and the tip for the US to back into being a net importer come the end of the winter months.
And from gas to oil, just some recent news just coming out today that we have the OPEC meeting, I believe it's tomorrow or this week at some point, which is the cartel, inverted commas, of Russia, Iran, Saudi Arabia, massive oil producers, excluding sort of the Western nations of America and others. Just recently, Russia said they were not intending, and Iran said they're not going to be cutting production. And just in the last couple of hours, that oil's tumbled 4%. So I really just want to get your opinion on where you think oil is going to be and what you think the outcome of the OPEC meeting is going to be.
Yeah, so I think just as of today, there was actually reports coming out that I think Goldman Sachs said there's a 30% probability that OPEC will actually be able to strike a deal. So just from that, you can see that there is a major consensus that OPEC probably won't sign a deal. And there's been some news and some analysts have actually said that if OPEC do not manage to sign a deal, then they do expect oil prices to fall to as low as $35 a barrel come the start of 2017. So if they don't manage to strike a deal, then there will be a adverse effect. However, I do believe if they do not strike a deal right now, I do believe at the start of 2017, they'll definitely be able to get something done.
Yeah, just continuing from that, I would say equally that it is very unlikely that they are to reach a deal. However, if they are going to, as some people think that they will, they are obviously going to cut the production a lot, and this will increase prices, the price of oil globally. And this has meant that certain people were expecting this to happen, such as the BP share prices actually dropped 0.6% recently, as well as the RDSA share prices dropping by 0.21%, which means that people are anticipating this drop if they are to reach a deal.
What would you say are the key countries on either side of this debate? So obviously we have some countries like Iran who've just got their oil back on the world markets and wanting to pump as much as they can to gain market share, versus other countries that are opposing it. What do you think the country that's really going to stop any progress going to be?
I think definitely one of the key countries that are going to stop any progress would probably be Iran. I mean, I know Saudi Arabia, they were quite keen on getting this deal pushed because they are one of the largest producers, and to them, whether this deal goes through or not would not have as major effects compared to some of the other countries. So I definitely do think that some of the other smaller players are the big will be the determining factor of whether this deal actually pulls through or not, because I do know that Saudi Arabia really want this deal to go through because they believe it's in their best interest and the in the best interests of the industry for this deal to actually go through, so oil prices can actually rise. So if I had to pick a specific country, I'm not too sure about that, but I do definitely think it will be the smaller players at the end of the day that will have the determining effect of whether this deal actually goes through.
Well, we'll find out the outcome of that deal in the next couple of days. Perhaps it is a new normal for oil that is going to be $40 to $50 a barrel. We're going to have to wait and see. So thank you for that interesting analysis on the sort of developments in energy and industrials. You've got a company for that, us, is that correct?
Yes. So one of the countries I've one of the companies I've actually been looking at is Albemarle. So they're headquartered in Charlotte. And they're actually a global specialty in a chemicals company with leading positions in lithium, bromine, refining catalysts, and applied surface treatment. So currently, Albemarle currently trades at $84.24. And the major key thing, and like the key point around surrounding Albemarle right now, is the demand for lithium. So if we specifically focus on their lithium business, we see that demand for lithium has significantly increased in recent years due to the popularity of smartphones and other electronic gadgets that are powered by rechargeable lithium-ion batteries. And more specifically, demand is actually expected to rise for lithium to rev up what's been called the world's new oil as electrical vehicles become increasingly popular. So I'll pass over to Glenn now, who will talk about something that Luke Kissam, the chief executive of Albemarle, had mentioned a couple of days ago.
Yes, so as mentioned, one of the chief executives of Albemarle, Luke Kissam, has said that is likely the demand for lithium is likely to rise by 20,000 tonnes a year, every year until 2021, which is obviously a huge opportunity for the company as it is a leading producer of lithium. Furthermore, the rechargeable batteries and other areas of the sector are obviously very, very important. However, with the rise of rechargeable cars and things like that, the company itself has so many opportunities open to it over the next year, 5 years, however long, that I really think it is one to watch as it is going to grasp the future by storm.
On the point of lithium, I think it's massively sort of, you know, an exploitative resource. I think Deutsche Bank have a huge buy target on it and released a report, I think it was 120 pages long, just on one commodity. Do you have any figures on the supply of the commodity? How much is there available, you know, to tap from the ground, really?
Right, so I don't actually have any exact figures of how much is actually to tap right now, but as you building on what you said, Deutsche Bank actually said that although the Albemarle stock has gained 50% year to date, they do believe that the stock could rise another 10% in the following year. And actually, Goldman Sachs also said that electrical vehicles market share is expected to reach 25% in 2025. And this is up from the 3%, which is currently at today. So it gives you an indication that, you know, although I don't have the correct figures of how much lithium there is to tap into, there's definitely the ability to exploit that significantly, because without the amount of oil, it would not be possible to obviously achieve that 25% market share of electrical vehicles, which is obviously powered. And one of the main components of electrical vehicles is lithium. So that gives you some key facts there. And
just on that point, so you have this massive market growth in the demand for lithium. What makes you think that Albemarle, how do you pronounce the name?
Albemarle.
How do you think Albemarle will be able to capture this market growth?
So currently Albemarle is one of the leading producers of lithium. I believe they are second to one other company. And just recently this year, they had a acquisition of Rockwood. So I think this has definitely helped them boost their capacities and facilities in terms of capturing lithium. So I definitely do think that they will be they'll be quite well positioned compared to some of the other companies to handle the increase in demand. And I do think that some of the other smaller companies will not be able to handle this increase in demand, because the increase in demand is so rapid and so significant that there's been questions of whether supply will be able to meet demand. But I do definitely believe that Albemarle will be well positioned.
I think on that point is also, you know, could Chinese firms or, you know, countries that produce in a lower cost jurisdiction, could they learn from the technologies of companies like Albemarle? I mean, lithium is quite a homogeneous good, being a commodity. So there is potential that, you know, you could see some sort of upshoots and upsprings in China or sort of other areas like India actually producing the same quality good or similar quality good for a much cheaper price.
Yeah, I think just building, I definitely agree with that, because if you, Albemarle is obviously one of the biggest producers there, and they have obviously a fixed, I was reading today that they have a fixed region in which they actually search lithium for. And the problem with that is some of the smaller players in the industry are actually starting to expand their search for where they look for lithium. So I definitely do believe that maybe some of the players in China will be able to definitely get a leg up on Albemarle and maybe some of the other bigger producers. So that'll be interesting to look at.
Yeah, definitely for next week we could look at some of the supply of lithium, or next time you're on the radio. Well, thank you very much. That's really good from the financial team, really good from the energy team and industrials team. So that concludes the first radio show, and we'll have another two teams on next week.